Blog Talk Radio.
Darlings, it's Mummy, Sybil Brunson, bonjour mes amis, comment ça va, ça va bien, I hope we're all ça va bien-ing tonight. Darlings, Mummy's had what a week I've had. Oh my God, my darlings, I've had such a week. I'm not broadcasting to you from the revolving ballroom of the Café Berlin high atop the Chrysler Building in the heart of New York City. No, no, no. Mummy, through unexpected reversals of fortune and surprising recoveries and exciting things that have been going on, Mummy is now broadcasting to you tonight live from Minneapolis, downtown Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, and St. Paul is right across the street. Oh, darlings, it's a wonderful town. And what is the wonderful accent? Don't you know? I love the way they speak up here. It's probably an excess of cheddar cheese and dairy products is causing them to be so sunny and lovely and cheerful and slightly curvaceous. There's not a skinny person up here. They're all kind of wonderfully milk-fed people, and they do, when you turn on the radio, Muzak is often playing songs like Farmer and the Dell and things like that. Anyway, so I love Minneapolis. I love its people. A surprising number of very pretty girls. Pretty girls everywhere. It's almost distressing. Mummy had to wear like her Holly Golightly outfit, a big floppy black hat with a brim and sunglasses and black opera gloves. I've completely hidden myself away because they're all so sunny and lovely here. Darlings, I'm being cheerful. I'm being perky. And here we are on Come Now, Don't Sulk, which is, you know, that title speaks volumes, because that is one of my morals in life. My mottos is, you know, come now, don't sulk, because I'm given to sulking too. So I sort of use that on myself. But our topic this week, coincidentally, was loss, losing in life. And what can we gain from losing? What can we learn from losing? Can we survive losing? We want to encourage all of you to call in tonight. Our number is 323-784-9639. That's 323-784-9639. We'd like you all to call in tonight. And please tell us about your experience with loss and learning and possibly gaining from loss. Sometimes the worst setbacks in our lives, and I've had several really end-of-the-world losses, that have their strange tapestries into surprising bounty. It's so interesting how sometimes the most terrible setbacks can put you on a different path, which leads to another turn, which leads through another door, which leads up a staircase and down a hallway and to the right and then down an exit door and out into a back alley. And then suddenly there you are in love or a great career breakthrough or, if nothing else, brilliant insight. I am on the air right now through a series of dominoes tipping over that started 7 years ago. When I had a terrible setback and I lost a job, an apartment, and was diagnosed with cancer all in 7 days. Can you imagine such a thing? I lost an apartment, a job, and a career, really, and I was diagnosed with cancer all in 7 days. And that disaster set in motion all sorts of things which took me on a path, well, first of all, to all of you on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and opened me to the world and threw me into the lap of the internet And then through that, meeting my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful producer. Oh, what a segue that is. My producer tonight, of course, is Gwendolyn Holden Berry, and she is the executive producer of Here Be Monsters, the Here Be Monsters Network, which is on Blog Talk Radio, and which is the network, the production company of which our lovely show, Come Now, Don't Sulk, is a member. So I'm kind of a member of the family there on Here Be Monsters. And Gwendolyn Holden Berry is our lovely mother, whose breast we all suckle at on a weekly basis. Gwendolyn, am I allowed to say that sort of thing where this is a GP-rated show?
Oh, God.
I knew I was going to get Gwendolyn. Any mention of breasts, or specifically Gwendolyn's breasts, always gets laughter from the director's lounge there where she is sitting right now. She's actually in Florida right now. I'm in Minneapolis, and the rest of you are around the world listening, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard or daylight time. And then we have listeners right now who are in California, Hawaii, Australia. I've gotten emails from Pakistan. We have listeners in Pakistan who come on their computers in the middle of the night. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And I want to remind you that our sponsor is our sponsor every week is the wonderful Daughters of ISIS company, .com, which is, by the way, ISIS, yes, is ISIS, no relation to those unpleasant people who blow up the wonderful antiquities in the Middle East. No, these are the Daughters of ISIS, and it's daughtersofisis.com. The fragrant memories of our ancestors, they specialize in oils and wonderful toiletries and wonderful lotions and products that are fragrant and so wonderful for your skin and for your spiritual health. You know, it's wonderful to take care of our physical and our spiritual health at the same time. And the people at the Daughters of ISIS do that magnificently. Anyway, Gwendolyn, how are you doing tonight?
Well, thank you for asking, Mommy. I'm doing okay. I'll tell you, it was a difficult week to see such positive people take it stage left, if you will. But, you know, then I heard Robert De Niro on stage at the Tonys, and I was cheered. I was cheered. Oh, and our Parkland students from down here sang the song from Wrench, you know, 325, but you know the song.
Yes, of course.
And that cheered me up a great deal. But it has been a week. It has been a week.
Well, I think that first of all, it's interesting, even before the news about Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade, I was planning on doing this anyway. This subject is loss, learning, and possibly gaining from loss, partly because yesterday was Judy Garland's 97th birthday or whatever, and her the 49th anniversary of her death is only a week away. She died in 1969 on June 22nd, I believe, which many people feel is one of the things that instigated the Stonewall riots. It was kind of an odd coincidence that it happened right about that time. Anyway, in Greenwich Village on Sheridan Square. But back to Judy Garland dying. At the time that she died, a lot of people wondered if it was suicide because her life had been so troubled and she had been so brilliant. But it was a coincidence that Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain both died within days of each other. Here are two people in the public eye. Kate Spade, of course, with her not only fashion sense and accessories, and then she, of course, branched into everything, housewares and fragrances and everything. But what was interesting about Kate was that her product line, her sensibility was so much about cheerfulness. It was so girlish. It was so happy. It was so floral and colorful and bright and patterned. And it was sweet. It was like the return to the freshness of the 1960s, when people began wearing bright colors after the sort of charcoal and pink and gray of the 50s. People in the 60s began wearing day glow saturated colors, and there was paisleys and, you know, all sorts of things. That was very Kate Spade. And here was someone who had espoused wonderful causes and had been so much about women's empowerment and children, you know, children's welfare and everything. And here we are. She hanged herself, which, of course, is a statement in itself. And she had a child herself, a 13-year-old. And so what does that mean? What does it say? Anthony Bourdain, totally a bon vivant, eating what, Cambodian food or something with Barack Obama, a world traveler, funny and wry and ironic and satirical, and apparently having a wonderful relationship with his fiancée, and took his life. It baffles people. And what I found especially interesting was that I watched the Sunday morning show on CBS in New York. It's on Channel 2, CBS Sunday Morning, whatever that is, with Jane Pauley. And they put in a special fill-in. So they bumped a story, 4-H clubs and making jams and jellies with Mo Rocca or something. And they bumped that, and they put in a special on suicide and the fact that the statistics on suicide are there. It's thunder striking to hear. Did you know that more Americans die from suicide than die in car accidents?
Yes.
It's inconceivable. If you had said to me on Saturday night, Sybil, I want you to tell me what the top five killers are in the United States, I would have said, well, heart disease, cancer, car accidents, gun violence, and unfortunate jams and jelly making incidents in the kitchen. Things where you know you're boiling those mason jars and the jelly explodes and kills mother and grandmother and two of the cousins or something. I mean, I would have said anything, but I would have thought suicide would be way down. And not only is suicide a bigger killer than car accidents, and they, by the way, that includes drunken and texting car accidents, which is epidemic. So suicide is a bigger killer than that, but it is increasing in a startling way for everybody, and especially for women. Women are committing suicide left and right in an age when you would think that the Me Too movement and everything that's been going on since Gloria Steinem in the 60s and 70s, you would think that with the bumps and the setbacks, the little setbacks, but the graph is basically climbing for women and their rights and their empowerment. Women are victims of suicide increasingly every year. It's astounding. What does it say about hopelessness? What does it say about giving up? What does it say about being an American, frankly, after this G7 thing? I mean, Canada is trying to build a wall right now, and what they've done is they've gone to Home Depot and bought up all the picket fencing they could get, and pet spray, and they're literally building a fence right now just a few miles north of here on the Minnesota-Canadian border. They can't take any more Americans. It's so dire a situation, simply because we're in terror for our lives now at the hands of Congress and the Senate and that jiggling bag of monkey pudding that lives in the White House with his family. Yes.
Mummy, yes. I'd like to add in there, too, as long as we're going through the numbers, that since March of 2016, the suicide rate has jumped 19%.
Yes. Yes.
There
absolutely
is a mentality over society. You know, it's the artisans and entertainment make such an influence.
Yes.
And that's your job, Mommy.
Well, I try. I try. I know that I don't succeed very often. I'm scolded often by people on the internet and in speech, you know, for my stance on different things. I'd like to open the phones, though, please. Please call in the number again, and I will let me have it right here. Our switchboard is open, and we are eager to hear your opinions on losses that you've suffered and how you have come through it. So please feel free to call in to 323-784-9639. That's 323-784-9639. 9639. I'd like to remind you that we would love to hear your stories, but we are not a suicide prevention line. Mummy is only my only degree, a real professional degree, which I got at Bryn Mawr, is on fashion accessories and hair do's and don'ts. And speaking of hair do's and don'ts, while I'm waiting to get a phone from someone, and please don't be afraid to call in. Really, seriously, call in. If this doesn't make you feel suicidal, what will? The meeting of the North Korean jiggling bag of monkey pudding with our own jiggling bag of monkey pudding. Talk about hair do's and don'ts. The hair do's of these two individuals alone should warn the world against this kind of diplomacy. People should not be allowed to be the heads, and I put heads in italics there, of countries when they wear their hair that way. Mummy has always said that there are hair do's, there are hair don'ts, and then there are hair death penalties. You know something? It's like hair don't, hair please don't, hair I've asked you 12 times not to do that, and then finally it's a hair death penalty. I'm sorry, Mr. Trump's hair is, if that isn't a trip to the electric chair, or perhaps that's how he got that hair, I don't know. And Kim Jong-un, I mean, he was never pretty. He wasn't pretty for 8 minutes, not even in the cradle. But why would anyone sculpt their hair into some strange, perverse, I don't know what that is, but it's scary. Anyway, the results of the G7 meeting and the fact that it may be, you know, dropped to G6 once we are kicked out, is just, the whole thing is so upsetting. But we've got to rise above this. I wonder if this is what's happening with the suicide rate increasing. Are people, do you think, is it so exhausting now? Or how do I say this? Look, life is tough. And there are decades where life is tougher. So the roaring 20s seem to be happy and cheerful and abundant. And then the 30s were about the depression. Okay. And the suicide rate, you know, skyrocketed. And of course, that was from external circumstances and people feeling hopeless. And many economists and politicians and philosophers saying that perhaps depression would be the way of the world. Permanently. They wondered if a permanent world depression would be the way the planet unwound. And then, of course, well, sadly, World War II stimulated the economy, but resulted in the deaths of, you know, millions and millions and millions and millions of people. So that wasn't exactly perky. But the whole thing is that things get better, things get worse. Things go left, things go right. Things expand, things shrink. And people and countries seem to ride those waves. We seem to be living in a time where we're curing diseases, sort of. We seem to be in a time when technology is doing almost as much good as it's doing bad. We seem to be trying to address things like overpopulation or ecology or things. Then we have an election like the one that we just went through in this country, and the news or the polls of American citizens are that most people are running out of fuel. They are exhausted by the headlines. Now, my parents never said they were exhausted by the headlines back when I was a child. My uncle, Cyrus, didn't say that he found the headlines so depressing that he did not pick the newspaper up off the front table when he came in the house and said, I won't read the paper. Please just use it as, you know, fuel for the barbecue. People are not wanting to watch the news. They're not wanting to read the news. They're wanting not to hear anything because it is too grinding. And if people get hopeless enough, not just on their own bills, and their own woes with their children or their spouses or the dog that urinated on the brand new carpeting, all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that befall every person in the world, but that the general world itself has wound itself out. Is that too much? Is that too much?
Well, Mommy, that's
yes, I'm here.
That's the moment that the hero walks in, or the shero walks in.
I love you, Gwendolyn. That is true. that something does happen. I'm Irish and I'm an Aquarius. I was born in the year of the dragon, and those three things, you know something, we have a lot of sadness in us, but it's also where we get our comedy and our strange, odd, lyrical optimism too. And I believe you. I'm on the same page as you, Gwendolyn. I think that things get very, 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 very bad. And then there's something the universe says, something happens. Something happens where the hero walks through the door. And I think that we see heroics in 7-year-olds today. I think that Lester Wolfe on NBC at the end of that NBC News evening, when they do the wonderful people thing, and some 7-year-old who lost his fight, you know, when he was 2, has opened a lemonade stand so that he can raise money for war veterans or the local fire truck or for orphaned animals. The most surprising hope exists, I think, at our very fingertips, in our own little yard. It's so strange, as inexorable and implacable as the wildflowers that come up in the spring in the worst places in the world. I'm in Minneapolis, and I drove around all day today, and on every highway and turnpike and freeway in this city, there are wildflowers growing by the wayside. So where there's litter in New York City, there are wildflowers of every color and description growing wild on the hillsides on either side of the turnpikes. And this is Minneapolis, where the temperature in April is 15 below. I mean, this is not an environment that is conducive to floral. And this is what I was seeing in the cast tonight. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm getting emotional. It's so encouraging. It was so encouraging to see those flowers and think they had a devastating winter. And this is what happens. You have fields of wildflowers growing right back again. And maybe that's the metaphor for our lives, is that the next generation, children come, they look at each other, they're black and white and yellow and red and green and purple, they're Hindus and Muslims and they're Catholics and Protestants and they've got 2 legs or they've got no legs, they are fat or thin, whatever they are, they come into the world with basically an open heart. Very hard work to wreck that, the way the Rodgers and Hammerstein, that you have to be carefully taught. And I think more and more people are not teaching their children to be haters, are teaching their children to care about other people, not only to care about other people, but to care about other beings, to care about animals, to care about flowers, to care about nature, to care about someone who's on the other side of the world that they may never even meet and shake hands with, but they care about them, and that's where we will all find ourselves in this new millennium. We are 18 years into it, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm not seeing any phone calls coming in, so I worry that means that everyone's just listening, or perhaps it's Monday bath night. What do you think, Gwendolyn?
I think people are listening, they're pausing, they're reflecting, but I'll tell you, seeing all those flowers, that's magical. And then relating them all to the children who are doing so much today on their own and through technology, they get across the world to help one another, that's pretty magical too. And it reminds me that sooner or later, everything comes up roses.
Yes. Yes, I am someone, I'm not a magical thinker, by the way. So even though I'm an Aquarius, I don't want people to think that I'm a cult joiner. I am not, you know, I'm not someone who ever wore a big tie-dyed muumuu. Well, I didn't when I was young, but now my figure is so frightening. I look like Jabba the Hutt from the neck down. So I often do wear floral print muumuus. And I even decorate them with elaborate necklaces. And all sorts of accessories. Janelle told me that was the best thing to do. But I, even though I'm not a joiner or a character out of the musical Hair or, you know, someone who was rolling in the mud naked in Woodstock, I do believe, I believe in metaphors. I believe that there are metaphors around us which we can apply to our lives. I believe that my garden, which took such a serious hit this past winter on Fire Island, and that half of it came back, and came back with a vengeance. So half of it died because of the brutal cold and the reluctant spring and the extended winter. The winter was not only extended, but it was severe. But the half that came back was dynamic and wonderful, and that gave me hope. Again, seeing all of this wildflower here, I think it's so lovely that the Minneapolis, the Minnesotans, don't mow this all down and plant sad grass that they can't keep mowed by their turnpikes the way we do in New York. That's really idiotic. We should let the grass go completely wild and throw wildflower seeds everywhere and turn every square inch of public land into a wildlife sanctuary. Maybe the bees will come back. They certainly are suffering terribly. But to see those flowers, to know that there is this grassroots, you know, or flower roots movement in the world of children interacting with each other on the internet, and perhaps for every bully, an incident that is bullying, there's 100 incidents of people reaching out and being loving. I believe that the Thomas Edison of tomorrow is maybe a five-year-old right now on the internet learning how to do a cold fusion or something, or to learn how to turn all the plastic in the landfill into fertilizer for enriching our soils. Or who knows? But with the internet so available to so many young children, perhaps there are 2 5-year-olds talking right now about how to solve wind energy and solar energy and make it more affordable. I hope and I invest in hope all the time. You've heard me say it before. And I feel that losses, and I have had my share of losses, the 3 I told you about, that career gone, that apartment, that home gone, and then the diagnosis of cancer all in 7 days. That is not the worst losses I've ever suffered. That's not it. Believe me, I buried 90% of my friends because of the AIDS crisis. I have known death in my family early on, and I've survived a lot. But yet, even in my darkest times, I have found that if I can hold on long enough and breathe, and I notice I said, I breathe. Don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath. You breathe through it, like labor. You breathe through it. When you breathe through it and you keep breathing through it, you find the things to say thank you for in the darkest times. You go to the friend that you enjoy being when you're in your saddest. You go out and do what the French do. You take your $3 and you spend half of it on flowers and half of it on bread. That's the old thing about the French who are poor. They always spent a franc on flowers and a franc on bread. You put on some music that you love. You pet the cat. You scratch the dog's ears. You smile at a baby. You find anything and everything that you can that brings you joy, even in small dosages, and then you say thank you for that. You're present to it. And at some point, the worst times become richer times. And even people who I've known who've been terminally ill and challenged have found great peace and great beauty and great appreciation for what they have had as they move forward and on into a new adventure, a new place. They have so treasured what they have and have had that they come to a place where moving forward is no longer a source of anger or angst or resentment or blame or why me. It's a place that has a kind of, there's so many words I could say, but peace. There's a peace to it. Not resignation, peace. And an appreciation then of every second that's left, of hugging someone that has come to see you in a whole new way, with much more depth and much more breadth, because you realize that every second has been an extraordinary adventure. Even the rough ones have been extraordinary adventures. One thing I love discussing with my friends is the nature of talent and loss. And speaking of which, can you be as talented as Judy Garland, for instance? Can you be that funny, that musical, that heartbreaking without having had tremendous loss and pain? I think every comedian I've ever known, the funniest people I've ever known, have been people who've been in tremendous pain and are not only in pain, but hold it and look at it. They it's not that they roll in it, although some people do roll around in their anguish and their angst and flash it on everybody else. But there are people who are in anguish as artists and creative people who then hold it in their hands and look at it and say, ah, this is what my pain looked like. These are my injuries. These are my setbacks. These are my woes. When I went to my shrink for the first day, I said, will I ever feel better? Her name was Arlene. She saved my life. And I said to her at the end of the session, which was 18 hours. Well, I paid her a great deal of money, but that was another story for another time. But I said at the end of the session, I said, Arlene, am I ever, ever, ever going to feel better? And she said, I think of our problem as being like luggage, like baggage. And I said, but will I be able to get rid of any of this baggage? And she said, we will get rid of some of it. Path on exploration, on self-exploration, is not only trying to get rid of the meaningless baggage and clutter of our lives, but to learn how, and I'm getting emotional thinking about our life, but to learn how to carry our luggage more cleverly. Isn't that interesting? To carry our problems, our troubles, our woes more efficiently, to know them for what they are, and to see them and say, ah, I know you. You're my mother's feelings about me. Oh, you're my dad's treatment of me on my 8th birthday. Oh, you're this setback in 3rd grade. Oh, you're this feeling about your looks. Oh, you're this. So look at those suitcases, if you want, those hat boxes, put them and say, oh, yes, I remember you. I remember you. To put the lid back on the hat box, to tie up the ribbon on it, and either to dispose of it, if you're lucky enough to be able to, or to put it up on your shoulder with the other luggage and roll down the road of life and keep on going. And when those demons come back, you know, here's another metaphor, if you want to mix your metaphors. If those demons come up to you on the path of life and they walk up to you and say, I'm here again, look at me, I'm so-and-so, you can look at them and you can say, I know exactly who you are. I've known you for years. I've thought about you. I've talked about you with my friends. I've explored you, and I banish you. I choose not to have you come farther on this journey. And if you can't banish that demon, if you can't banish that trunk on your back, that particular problem or that suite of problems, then say, okay, yeah, come along for the walk. No problem. I'm going to ask you, please offer any conversation today. I'm going to stroll along and hum my song and go to my lunch thing or have my show with Gwendolyn or do whatever. But I'm going to disinvite you from talking too much to me today. You know, if you want to chat my ear up tomorrow, you do that, but not now. If I have to carry this suitcase with me along with all the other luggage, I'm going to put it up on my shoulder like a Dr. Seuss cartoon, like those wonderful cartoons where he would draw those things that seemed to be like about to fall over, but never did. And just put that suitcase with those demons in it up on top and say, yeah, no problem. I'm doing my show. I'm so grateful for Gwendolyn and Daughters of Isis and people that listen in and drop me the wonderful notes and messages afterwards. And that's life. That's going to have to be my life. I don't know what else to say. Is suicide something that, you know, I've thought of, that everyone's thought of? I don't think anyone is being honest who says, oh, I've never thought about suicide. It's like, how could you not? I think animals are sentient enough to think about suicide. I think, you know, it's something that is always lurking. To be alive is to be in danger of dying. It goes with the package. It's part of the menu. Oh, you open the menu of life. Oh, look at that. Down by the
the gratuity suggestion. By the way, you'll be dying someday. That's the menu of life. At the bottom of the dessert area, you look at the desserts, then they offer you the cheese plate. I think it's so sad. Why would I have a delicious dessert and then cheese plate? No, thank you. That's a little too French for me. And then there's an aperitif thing, and then there's, you know, our food. Oh, please let your service person know about allergies, and pregnant women should not eat oysters, Rockefeller, or something. And then below that is, we suggest that, oh, there will be an 18% tip put on parties of six or more. We do suggest 18% or 20% for your service person. And then in very fine print at the bottom, we hope you enjoyed your stay here at the Restaurant of Life. By the way, after your check is paid, you will be dying, you understand? That's the menu of life. To dine at the menu, you know, to dine at the Restaurant of Life. Auntie Mame said that life is a banquet and most poor bastards are starving to death. Well, she was right. When you sit down to the banquet of life, you should serve yourself and you should experience all sorts of delicious, you know, delicacies from all around the world. Think of all the people you could meet. You could learn the piano, play the piano at 57 years of age. You could go to Paris for the first time in your life at 80. You could learn how to cook Thai food. You could shake the hands of the nice lady with the man with the turban who's walking down the street right now. You could do all sorts of things. That's the menu of life. That's the banquet of life. But remember that to be in life is to know that someday it will be gone, and that's law. But you're not supposed to live in a shoulda, woulda, coulda world. You're not supposed to live in a world of, like, not serving yourself the magic of life. That is the ultimate law, I think.
Well, Mommy, you know what Tony Bourdain said?
Did you say that again, Gwendolyn? You went out for a second. Yes?
Anthony Bourdain. I always pronounce his name. Tony said that your body isn't a temple. It's an amusement park. Enjoy the ride.
I love that. I love that. You know, it's so funny about Anthony Bourdain. I've looked at pictures of him when he was young. Hey, my God, he was kind of handsome when he got older. He was a shockingly homely boy. Oh, my God, with that shoulder-length, strange Janis Joplin hair and, you know, terrible posture. I mean, he was really shocking. But what is so strange is that Anthony Bourdain, as a youngster, moved in the same circles as I did. He was a chef in Greenwich Village. He was a chef in Provincetown. He lived in places that were like within a block or two of me all the time. And I keep looking at these pictures of him back in 1969 and 1974 and 1978. And I keep thinking, good heavens, did that boy actually walk by me? He's so startlingly homely. And to know that he was unfolding in this amazing way, through drugs and then cleaning up and saving himself and, oh, my God, all the stuff that he went through to become this wonderful creature, this wonderfully interesting and exciting creature. And I wish him peace and joy on his journey.
Yeah.
Because it breaks my heart that he couldn't live to be 312 like Julia Child, because Julia Child came to her cooking at 40 years of age. You know, that's the old thing about, like, people say the overnight sensation, and, oh, Julia Child must have been a chef when she was 11. No, she was not. She was actually a government worker. She was a civil servant of sorts with her husband.
That's right.
And she came to cooking, you know, out of, like, curiosity and a hobby, and then she found a talent for it. And here's a woman, and I use this with my students, my life coaching students all the time. I say, if you think that you haven't found yourself at 18 or 25 or even 30, and you have parents, you know, tapping their foot and, you know, drumming their fingers on the counter and going, you know, Myrtle, why haven't you become what you're presented by? You know, it's like, tell them about Julia Child, a giantess. She was 7'4". She weighed 300 pounds. She was a giantess, and she came to cooking at 40. She was thwarted at every turn by snobby French people who thought that an American housewife had no business trying to do this. And then, step by step, loss by loss, she met the right people. She had her two girlfriends, Simone Beck especially, and she wrote a book, and then that book was refused and was thwarted, and then she kept on going, and she became the food giant of the 20th century, starting at 40. She started at 40. She smoked, drank, ate bacon and butter every day of her life, and lived to be 177 years old, whatever. This is a miracle. She hated margarine. She didn't believe in all sorts of silly dieting things. She simply gulped life. She found something she loved above and beyond her husband, Paul. And she loved sharing food and teaching people. And that came to her late. And she had light coming out of her. Light coming out of her. And she certainly had heart things. She and Paul were unable to have a child, which she ached for. She was desperate to have a child, which she was never able to accomplish. But she breathed through the trouble, and she found the path. And I wish that Anthony Bourdain could have done the same thing. So now, oh my God, a life full of challenges and setbacks and misery and heartbreak, but she breathed through it all, and she lived to be, and she smoked like a chimney, and she drank and ate, and she, you know, I say, Chanel is one of those women that you can't look away from. I always use her as a life lesson. Martha Graham, Coco Chanel, Louise Nevelson, and Diana Vreeland. Okay, those women. Think of them again, right? Coco Chanel, Diana Vreeland, Louise Nevelson, right? Martha Graham. None of those women were pretty for more than 7 minutes in their lives. Chanel might have been pretty when she was like 11. She might have been kind of a cute, gawky girl for like 11 minutes, and then it was gone. The moment was gone. The dew had evaporated, and she turned into that, what she was. You couldn't look away from her. You couldn't look away from her. She figured out how to dress, how to accessorize. And she not only did that, this is where I just get so, well, I can't say the F word, but you know the word I'm thinking. This is where I get so effing joyous and defiant. She took all those setbacks, all those losses, and she said, I'm not only going to dress beautifully for myself, I'm going to make half of the world wish they could look like me. That's what she did. And she did it, and she died, and Karl Lagerfeld continued on to do it. It's like, oh, my God, how do you do that? Louise Nevelson, a sculptress, you know, an artist, she was like, who was that? She's like a bug. She's like a giant bug with a staff and a turban-y thing. But she made incredible sculptures and competed in a world, a post-World War II world of abstract expressionism. Brilliant. Martha Graham, oh, dear God. Oh, my God, people aren't allowed on stage that look like that. She was like another bug. And look, Martha Graham changed the face of dance, of dance performance in this past century. And the last one, Diana Vreeland. Oh, my God. She became the arbiter of good taste and fashion and beauty, looking like that. And you know what? Who cares? You couldn't look away from her. People simply had to stare at her because she was so compelling. You adore the fact that she put rouge on her cheek and continued it up into her ears. She rouged her ears. She put on 50 pounds of costume jewelry every day. She was 4'4". She weighed 18 pounds. And she could barely lift the 55 pounds of plastic and clunky stuff that she draped herself in, and you couldn't look away. And when she walked into the room and she sat at the head of the table, girls who were like absolutely gorgeous said, yes, ma'am, and followed orders. She was like the Adolf Hitler of fashion. And she told some intern to blow her brains out. The intern would curtsy, leave the room, and there would be a bang in the outer office. Anna Wintour thinks she's so big, such a big deal. There's another one. Anna Wintour, was she pretty a day in her life? No. And she continues to look like Buster Brown's shoes, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, where's the little dog that's supposed to be beside her? She looks like a Dutch Boy paint ad, except that she's in a $5,000, you know, Hermes dress. And so it's like, oh, for heaven's sake. But these are people that take those setbacks and those losses and those, I mean, you're talking about women that aren't pretty. The world has no interest in women that aren't pretty. Unless it does. Until it does. Betty Davis.
Lillian.
Betty Davis is beautiful, you know? And there, look at her. She was an amazing thing. Have we run out of time? Have I talked too much?
No. I agree with you about Betty Davis. Absolutely. I was mentioning, though, an undersung heroine of mine, Lillian Hellman. And Dorothy.
Oh, my God,
Parker.
Lillian. Oh, yes. 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 First of all, Gwendolyn, I love you for that. Lillian Hellman and Dorothy Parker. First of all, the two of them were a mess. They each had terrible, terrible, terrible lives, huge problems in them, you know, great angst and everything. And they created absolutely amazing work. They were lucky in the sense that they were writers, and so they were never judged on their looks per se, because the circles of men they traveled with were not judging them on their looks, at least not for their faces. Edna Ferber is another one. Think about Edna Ferber with George. I'll think of it in a second. That's so stupid. George Kaufman. Edna Ferber. There's the holy three right there. You know, Lillian Hellman, Dorothy Parker, and Edna Ferber. I mean, my goodness, not 3 minutes of beauty between the three of them. But they were absolutely amazing artists. They competed in a different place where they just had to be good at the typewriter. But now I'm sorry, what is it?
I said, as you said before, they gulped life. They really did.
Yes. Oh, gulped life. And sadly gulped booze as well as cigarettes. I mean, oh my God, Dorothy Parker. When she was taking a bath in gin, whatever she didn't swallow, I guess she lathered up with. I mean, but it's difficult. You know, I mean, these people, to the women who were involved in the beauty industry, you know, again, you know, in the world of dance, Martha Graham, you're going to go out and dance on a stage and come up with, you know, movement and art, and people are going to be saying things like, Jesus, that girl is homely. That is not a pretty girl. You know, this is not a classic Balanchine ballet dancer. And her attitude was, F you, I'm going to make it wonderful. Betty Davis was surrounded by platinum blondes, and she herself tried it for a short amount of time. But Betty Davis was the first person to say that she turned to the character work early. She said, give up the ingenue stuff and turn to the character work. I want to tell you a little story, apocryphal. I'll tell it fast. Joan Blondell was on a show. I believe it was Johnny Carson. And he was asking her, what was it like to be, you know, this wonderful blonde bombshell in the 30s. And, you know, I loved Joan Blondell. She wasn't a typical actress. There was a lot of things about her that were adorable in those Busby Berkeley musicals. And she said it was great. And she said that when they were at MGM and the different, you know, the big musicals, you'd have 80 platinum blondes, all identical, all under hair dryers in the makeup and hair wings of MGM. And she said you'd go down the rows and it would be like a musical number right there. You'd see 80 girls under 80 matching hair dryers, with 80 manicurists working on their hands and 80 makeup people doing the thing. It was like a musical thing. And at the very end, you'd see Betty Davis, for instance. I don't know if it was Warner's or RKO or whatever. But she said there was Betty Davis, and Betty Davis would be having her hair bleached blonde so that she could be in the Petrified Forest or whatever, or the Marked Woman. And she would be a platinum blonde because that was the thing. You were supposed to be a platinum blonde. You know, everyone was supposed to be a knockoff of Jean Harlow. And the difference was that all the girls, Joan Blondell said, were talking about boys they were dating, the bracelet they got from this guy or the guy that they're thinking of marrying, blah, 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 and the role, blah, blah, all the gossip. And Betty Davis would be the one with glasses on reading a script. and they would tease her and say, Betty, what are you doing? And she'd say, oh, I'm just looking over some scripts. And they thought she was a loser. They thought she was an idiot. Because she was like, what are you doing? Well, what she was doing was she was saying, you know what? I'm kind of pretty, but I'm only going to be pretty for about 27 more minutes this afternoon. I'm only going to be pretty in about 3 films. And then I'm going to have to be really, really clever. And I've got to be willing to do, you know, I can do Petrified Forest, but I also have to be willing to do Of Human Bondage and play a girl who's, and well, I won't say the word, but is, you know, she dies of syphilis at the end. She's dying of syphilis. That was considered to be the end of a career. When she was disfiguring herself to play Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, or when she was disfiguring herself to play Regina in Little Foxes, people said, what are you doing? Look at Crawford. She's holding on to every minute she can to be pretty. Crawford was still trying to be an ingenue in the 50s. This is insane. Insane and pathetic, by the way. And pathetic. Right? Look at Davis. Look at Katharine Hepburn. She was the same way. She said, yep, this is who I am, and I'm bony and angular, and you know what? My features are based so much on bone and so little on baby fat that I might get better looking as I get older. While all you pretty blondes start to look saggy and everything, I never had an ounce of fat on me. So my face is like a Mount Rushmore face. It's chiseled out of New England granite. And that's what she did. And look at her. You can't look away from her. Oh, my God. And guess who's coming to dinner? She's impossibly beautiful. Helen Mirren, another one. Judi Dench. They're aging into these wonderful creatures. Wonderful creatures.
Yeah.
All with loss, all with setbacks, all with tragedy. Right?
Right.
All right, listen, I talked the whole show away, so I'm just going to make a couple of quick announcements. I want to remind everybody that you can find Mummy on Come Now, Don't Sulk on the Here Be Monsters Network on Blog Talk Radio every Monday night live, and that's 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Right? Eastern Daylight Time. So it's 7 Central Time, which is where I'm. Oh, I just realized. It's 8 where you are, Gwendolyn, right?
Yes, it is.
It's 7 where I am. Oh, darling, when we sign off, I'll just do the show all over again because it won't be 8 o'clock. Oh, that's wrong. Oh, I'm getting. Do you realize that if I were to take a jet and fly very quickly, very, very quickly west, I would continue to get younger and younger and younger until finally I passed the international dateline and I would be an entire day younger. But if I did that at the speed of light, I would be actually 100 years younger in no time at all. I've got to speak to Albert Einstein about this. This is a new theory of relativity. If I just keep flying west, I'm sure that I will just keep younger and my skin will look lovely. And I shall suggest that to my wonderful sponsors, the Daughters of Isis.com. Perhaps the Daughters of Isis.com should do something with Virgin Airlines, and we should actually book flights for customers and fly them west while we apply the Daughters of Isis products, and we'll get younger and younger and younger and younger. Of course, we will have to be willing to live in North Korea because we'll have traveled that far west that we will then finally be east. But that's another topic for another time. DaughtersofIsis.com, the fragrant memories of our ancestors. Do go to their site, boys and girls. DaughtersofIsis.com, wonderful products. I want to remind everybody on Facebook that if you share my posts, stories, anecdotes, and recipes, even if you just share these Come Now, Don't Sulk announcements with the link, every time you share, your name goes on a slip of paper, and that slip of paper goes in our Tumblr. And at the end of June, we're going to select another Sharing the Love winner. Last month's was Mary Jane Nielsen of the Bronx, and she's gotten a wonderful I Want You to Vote Sybil Brunson coffee cup from Zazzle. Zazzle.com, where you can buy any of the Sybil Brunson products, and she's getting her own I Want You to Vote coffee cup, which she can have and share her mocha, morning mocha with Mummy every morning. I want to make a couple of, if you'd like to come to my shows on Fire Island, I'm going to be doing my Smarty Pants review show on Fridays at Terry's on the Bay. Hello, everybody at Terry's on the Bay, Kevin and Jackie and Will in the kitchen. fabulous food at Cherries on the Bay, right in the heart of Cherry Grove. Do come there and join us Friday at 4-ish for our Smarty Pants Trivia Challenge. We've got great prizes and lots of laughs, fun and funny surprises every Friday night, and I will see you there. What else am I supposed to? Oh, did you know that Mummy's writing again? Yes, on summer newspapers. I'm writing for the Fire Island News, which goes all over the South Shore. So it's not just on Fire Island, it's also on Long Island. So it covers like several thousand people, readers, and all 17 towns on Fire Island. And it's the Fire Island News. Do look for my articles there in Sybil Says. How are we running on time? We've got about 5 minutes. Darlings, I really do want to encourage you that if you don't want to write, call in, do write me private messages on Facebook. And address questions for us. I'd like to acknowledge the passing this week of Michael Volbrock, the great designer and illustrator from the 1970s. Michael Volbrock is the one who did those drop-dead brilliant illustrations for Bloomingdale's back when people actually had fashion illustrations. This is what I wrote: a salute and a heartfelt toast to the handsome and talented, the funny and fabulous, the saucy and subversive Michael Volbrock, whose taste and artistry were definitely magnificent holdovers from another far more golden age. How lucky, lucky we were to have had him in a far less glamorous or deserving decade. Youngsters today can't imagine a time when you could open a newspaper, an ordinary newspaper, and be greeted by a full-page illustration of one of Michael's impossibly beautiful fantasy women wearing some chic chemise from Bloomingdale's. I was fortunate to run into and chat with him on many occasions during the glory days of the nightclubs and dance palaces back in a far more eccentric, interesting, and chic New York City. Bless you on your journey, Michael Volbrock, and may heaven be at least as gorgeous as how you would have painted it. And I mean that sincerely. I did a tribute to Judy Garland, which I was going to read to you, but I don't want to bore you. But if you go to my Facebook page, you will see a tribute that I did to her, specifically her acting, and her acting in The Wizard of Oz, specifically in the scene between her, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Woodman when they have just escaped the witch, the Wicked Witch of the West. It's in the first third of the film, and her acting in that is absolutely it's life-changing. And I wrote a little essay there, as I do about film. And I'm going to collect those and put those in my book as well. People have said, well, are you going to do your book? And I am, and I'm going to put lots of different things and recipes and all sorts of things. I'd like to say a special, I want to thank Gwendolyn again for being my producer. And I'd like to say my hellos tonight, Richard Skipper and Russ Woolley, Herb Ainer, oh, how are you, darling, Jesse Galvez. Thank you for tuning in tonight, Matt Decker, Sheila, Janet. Hi to John and Juan, Flick Williams, Eileen and Stephen, Paulette, how are you, Minky, Gabrielle and Sarah, lovely to see you, Patrick Hoy, Aditi, the gang at Cowgirl Restaurant, thank you for joining me tonight, Lee and Harriet and Joan, thank you so much, Elaine and Jimmy Rassiope, lovely to see you, Derice, Lawrence, Rachel, Amy and Peggy, Casey, Mr. Thornton, Tallulah, darling, how are you? Truly Scumptious, I hope you're doing well. Robert, Judy, Vance, Kim, Joellen, John, Carl, and Mr. Thornton. Geffel Teffish, of course, Jay Rogers, Tommy Thayer, Jesse Galvez, Monsieur Rishi, I love you, and of course, my own Mr. Payamas. Mr. Payamas, how are you tonight? Everybody, it's always a pleasure to be here with you every Monday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I look forward to seeing you next week. We'll have another subject. Please join in. Don't let Mummy blab her whole hour away. Gwendolyn's doing her very best to keep me propped up, and I promise that next week I'll be back in New York City, okay? High atop the revolving ballroom of the Cafe Berlin in the Chrysler Building. Gwendolyn?
Good night, Gwendolyn. Mommy.
Good night. You have a wonderful week, okay?
You too, darling.
And I love you, love you, love you. And Daughters of Isis, thank you for being our sponsors. I adore you all. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Be present, be mindful, be grateful. And most of all, kind to all the people around you, strangers and friends alike. Pat a dog, cuddle a kitty, smile at a child. Be good to yourselves. Good night, everybody.